Well, this is chapter 6 of Men of the Covenant by Alexander Smylie. And this chapter is entitled Sharp of That Ilk. Archbishop Sharp was a brutal persecutor of the people of God, and in the end, he was murdered. But the story of the Covenanters after the Restoration needs to be read with Sharp in mind, and that's what we're about to do. Lord Middleton and the nobles who abetted him were not the only foes of the church in the months that succeeded the Restoration. Bad as they were not the worst foes. They had for prompter a man about whom a modern historian has written that, in the most comprehensive sense of the word, he was a knave pure sang, a man whose life of calculating meanness happily has few parallels. Sharp of that ilk. Sharp by name, sharp by nature. Cromwell denominated him in a shrewd phrase, Sharp of the clan and family of the Sharps. Sharp, whose name corresponded with his nature, cunning, clever, in the baser forms of cleverness, owning only as good a heart as can be made out of brains, governed consistently by self-interest and self-regard. Oliver was a discerner of spirits. Oliver Cromwell. He saw into James Sharp's soul as he saw into James Guthrie's, and he distrusted the one as thoroughly as he honoured the other. We read about James Guthrie in the previous chapter, Honourable Man of God. Probably no one in the long story of the Scottish Church bears an uglier repute, and the scrutiny of scholars has rather blackened than brightened his record. His very handwriting, as it may be seen in the hundreds of letters he has left, is small, paltry, niggling, and exceptionally annoying. His style of composition is self-conceited and pedantic. We have his portrait painted by Sir Peter Lely. None of his brother presbyters had the gold which could procure such immortality. The face is not repulsive. It has not the bold and coarse brutality of Lauderdale's, but it is not a spiritual face. The forehead is low, the eyes are furtive and yet alert. Nothing escapes them. They have little pity and little patience. One does not associate them with droppings of warm tears. The lips are thin and firmly closed. If the features do not excite actual disrelish, neither do they attract. They remind us of the man of the world much more than of the ambassador of Christ. Sharp was born about the year 1618 in Banffshire, where his father was sheriff clerk, his mother being a gentlewoman of the name of Leslie. Neither at school nor at the university was he in any way distinguished. His intellect never climbed very high or plunged very deep. James Kirkton, in his Secret and True History, preserves a curious tale of his college days, perhaps apocryphal, certainly coloured by the hatred he aroused in later years. In bed one night with his comrade, he fell into a loud laughter which continued until the other awoke him and asked why he was so merry. He had been dreaming, he answered, that the Earl of Crawford appointed him Minister of Crail, the height of his ambition in his wholesomer youth. Again he fell asleep, and again he laughed, more loudly than before. And now when his companion recalled him to the solid earth, he was offended, for, said he, I thought I was in a paradise because the king had made me Archbishop of St. Andrews. Then rejoined his fellow, I hope you will remember old friends. But soon he was dreaming once more, and to different purpose, for he wept, most lamentably, for a long time. Being asked the cause of the alteration, he gave a reply which was tragic enough. I dreamed that I was driving in a coach to hell, and that very fast. What way he drove, adds Curtin, with grim brevity, I shall not say. Uncertainty hangs over his movements after he was done with the university. Apparently he was absent from Scotland for a while, probably in London, because when he returned to the metropolis, he was familiar with its streets and townsfolk. It is unlikely that he swore the covenant in 1638, but if he felt any aversion to subscribing the stringent deed, he managed to disguise it. When we meet him next, it is, as his dream predicted, in the church and manse of the Fifeshire village of Crail. One fears that the breath of heaven did not blow through his sermons. His letters, except when he denounces an opponent, are grey and hard, as the windstone and cheerless as the cold light of stars. He never was an evangelical. He never was vanquished by the cross. He had nothing more fundamental to recommend than those deeds of the law by which an apostle says a man is not justified. Mr. Warner tells me, Woodrow relates, that he was before Archbishop Sharp's death in conversation with two ladies of good sense and very serious. They told him that the bishop, when he and they were talking about religion, and one in the company said somewhat of the insufficiency of blamelessness and morality for salvation, returned the reply, "Be you good moralists, and I'll warrant you. Our hearts are forced to compassionate the parishioners of Crail," so who's teaching salvation by works and by our own goodness. From the Analecta, too, a second anecdote may be gleaned, which brings another impeachment against him. In the manse of King's Barnes, at no great distance from Crail, lived a young lady whom Sharp wished to win for wife, but, one Sabbath, being desirous to listen to a sermon from his lips, and equally desirous that she should not be recognised, Margaret Bruce contrived to veil her genuine self, and took the road that ran to Crail. Her wooer preached so well that all her hesitancies were swept away, and she resolved to be his bride. But between cup and lip much may intervene, for going soon after into her father's study, she found on the table a volume of sermons freshly come from England, and turning its pages, she saw that one was based on the text which she had heard James Sharp expound with such ingenuity. She read it and discovered that it was the original which he had copied with a faithfulness too literal and undeviating. He stood before her for what he was, no individual explorer of the realm of truth, but a mere plagiarist, which Providence opened her eyes so clearly that when he came again to renew his proposal, she utterly rejected his offer. But the clergyman was much away from his parish. He was a man to whom the machinery and diplomacy of the church were more interesting than its doctrine and its life. "I remember you have sometimes merrily called me a politician," he wrote to Patrick Drummond in the December of 1660, and Drummond's jest told the truth. A politician, and one who loved the underground passages of politics more than the breezier uplands. Sharp of that ilk was from first to last. He fought for the resolutioners, but we shall wrong his brethren if we conceive them animated by his spirit. David Dixon and Robert Douglas were severed from him like east from west. He was simply their indefatigable agent, a schemer with endless perseverance and secrecy and savoir-faire. Many a time, and for months at a stretch, Crail would see nothing of him. He was busily occupied in London. Thus it happened in 1657 and 1658, when Warriston and Patrick Gillespie and James Guthrie enjoyed Cromwell's regard, and when the great instrument of God to cross their evil designs, says Bailey in one of his letters to his cousin, has been that very worthy, pious, wise, and diligent young man, Mr. James Sharp. He's not diligent if he's away from his charge. Poor Bailey, he thinks it necessary to counsel so gracious an emissary to supplement the harmlessness of the dove with the wisdom of the serpent. I pray God help you and guide you. You had need of a long spoon. Trust no words nor faces, for all men are liars. The advice was superfluous, and the church's messenger returned to Edinburgh to report a substantial victory. He had gotten all the designs of the exceeding busy and bold remonstrants defeat, and the protector had dismissed him with very good words, assuring he should be loath to grant anything to our prejudice, and therefore we bless God that by Mr. Sharp's labours was kept off us for a time a much feared storm. So Sharp came away from Cromwell with favour. Yes, the blindness of Christian men is occasionally excessive, and nothing helps it more potentially than the false and unworthy heat of party zeal. The moment for Sharp's supreme treachery and for the bitter awakening of his friends was at hand. When it was evident that events in England preluded the reinstatement of the Stuarts, our kind, honest, Sharp friend, the characterisation and the spelling of those of the Earl of Rothes, was again sent up to London as envoy of the Kirk. He was to take care that, when Charles did recross the narrow seas, it should be as a covenanted and Presbyterian monarch. From the middle of February 1660 until long after the king was in Whitehall, he remained in the centre of intrigue and activity, and there were few of the plots of those hurrying weeks in which he did not have a finger. So, knowing a bearer whose usefulness in your service sets him far above my recommendation, it was with this benison that Lord Lauderdale introduced him to his royal master. But the church had need of a truer knight. His succour meant humiliation and calamity for the men who confided in his good faith. We require no evidence to condemn him beyond that which he has himself supplied. He had three correspondents during 1660 and 1661, and we are allowed to read the letters he sent to them. The first was Robert Douglas, the brave minister. The second was Patrick Drummond, one of the Presbyterian clergymen in England. The third was the Earl of Middleton. It might be hard at the time for those who hoped against hope to abjure their trusted agent, but in what he says to these three there is no difficulty now in tracing his juggling prevarication and betrayal. On the 1st of March 1660 he writes Douglas from London that the Cavaliers point him out as the Scottish presbyter. 10 days later that moderate episcopacy is setting up its head. In the same week that, along with Calamy and Ashe, the representatives of English nonconformity, he has convinced General Monk that a commonwealth is impracticable, and has beaten him off that sconce he hath hitherto maintained. When April comes, he sees not full ground of hope that covenant terms will be rigidly struck to. By the middle of the month, he is sure that the business of religion will be altogether waived in the treaty with the king. Before the end of it, he smells that moderate episcopacy is the fairest accommodation. And all this while, Douglas is encouraging him to keep unshaken his loyalty. 'Tis best that Presbyterian government be settled simply, for we know by experience that moderate episcopacy, what can it be other than bishops with cautions, is the next step to episcopal tyranny, which will appear very soon above board if that ground once be laid. You know the old... It seems like history is repeating itself in England today with the dreadful apostasy of the bishops. You know the old saying, perpetua dictatura via ad imperium. But the wise words were spoken in vain. In May, Sharp was over in Breda at Charles's court, and afterwards Robert Douglas confessed that now he began to have his suspicions. The first thing that gave me a dislike at him was that, when he was in Holland, he wrote to me in commendation of Hyde, an enemy to our nation and Presbyterial government. Yet the delegate of the Covenanters continued to assert his fidelity in unequivocal terms. He told how, when he met the king who surpasseth all ever I have heard or expected of him, he found him very affectionate to Scotland, and resolved not to wrong the settled worship and discipline of the church. He assured his correspondent that, while Presbytery was a lost cause in England, he could not believe that the service book was to be forced on the Scots. You know, he added, I am against episcopacy root and branch. Again, on the 16th of June, when Charles had been 3 weeks in London, this was his diagnosis of events. The present posture of affairs looks like a ship foundered with the waves from all corners, so that it is not known what course will be steered. But discerning men see that the gale is like to blow for the prelatic party, and those who are sober will yield to a liturgy and moderate episcopacy, which they phrase to be the effectual presbytery. And by this salvo they think they guard against breach of covenant. But I know, our Bayard asserts, this purpose is not pleasing to you, neither to me. And so things went on until his return to Scotland in autumn, when he carried with him a letter from the king promising to protect and defend the church, as it was settled by law. Some ambiguity hung about the stipulation, but the ministers of Edinburgh interpreted it as their wishes impelled, and read it as a gracious manifesto in vindication of the covenanted cause. They thought it not enough, Kirkton narrates, to praise it in their pulpits, but bought for it a silver box, a shrine for such a precious relic. The letters to Patrick Drummond take up the tale after Sharp is again in the north. Probably, although they were addressed to this Presbyterian minister, they were intended mainly for the eyes of Lauderdale, secretary at court for Scottish business, and all-powerful with his majesty. In them are the same tones of injured innocency, the same protestations, that the writer has not deflected by a hair's breadth from his principles. The course of my life, I bless the Lord, will not give evidence of my ambition and covetousness. I have served the interests of others more than my own. I never did seek anything of any. Whatever lot I may meet with, I scorn to prostitute my conscience and honesty to base, unbecoming allurements. There surely speaks an unsullied captain. If his friend asks his creed in a sentence, well, I am a Scot and a presbyter. If he desires a glimpse of his bulwark and fortress, my fence is in God, who knoweth that my regard to my country and this kirk doth preponder any selfish consideration. But by and by, the hidden man of the heart discloses himself more freely. So he was a deceiver. I do chain my affection to that stream of providence which may make it to be well with the king and your master. My lord, I am no fanatic, nor a lover of their way under whatsoever refined form. The accents of the opportunist rise to the surface in such words. Yet how weary was he was of legomachies. Legomachies, I haven't seen that word before. If he could not have leave to retire amongst his books and to bewail there the evils which folly and pride brought on his native land, then waft me from the harbour mouth, wild wind, I seek a warmer sky. I must think de mutando solo, and breathing in an air where I may be without the reach of the noise and pressures of the confusions coming. Ah, but we hear the snarl of the tiger sometimes. In the end of 1660 there is a letter through no intermediary but direct to Lauderdale. It is a revelation of the genuine James Sharp. In it, his hate of the protesters has frank avowal, and we learn who inspired the worst excesses of the persecution. I fear there can be no remedy against this malady without exercising severity upon the leading impostors, Guthrie, Gillespie, Rutherford, which will daunt the rest of the hotheads. So those Christians are called hotheads. Are you a Christian hothead? Better to be a Christian hothead than an unbelieving minister, who in time may be beat into sound minds and sober practices. We are permitted at last to hearken to the utterance of candour and veraciousness. Most damning of all, however, is a letter to Middleton. It is dated on the 21st of May, 1661, and is written from London. What has it to say? This, that Sharp was then holding constant interviews with Lord Clarendon and the English bishops, that the subject of their discussions was the establishment of episcopacy in Scotland, and that the project had his hearty approval. This also, that before he travelled south, he and the commissioner in Edinburgh had conferred on the same topic, and that he was aware of the commissioner's intention to humble the kirk. And this finally, that in his judgment, the superstructure for which Middleton has laid the foundation will render his name precious to the succeeding generations. Let us remember that only 2 months before he had boasted that thrice a week at least Mr. Douglas was with him, that there was no public matter he could learn which he did not impart to his friend, and that he had joined the Presbyterian leader in beseeching Lord Middleton to call a general assembly and to refrain from rescinding the Acts of Parliament which favoured the Covenanters. Let us remember too his asseveration to Patrick Drummond that he was resolved not to meddle any more in these stormy and bespattering entanglements. He has one language for the old associates, whom he befools, and a contradictory language for the new masters, whom he courts with a sycophant's assiduity. His circumlocutions and artifices, when he conversed with Drummond and Douglas, with a courtesy of Geraint, courtesy with a touch of traitor in it. Even Robert Bailey, stung into what for him his unwonted courage, speaks some plain truths to Lord Lauderdale. If you or Mr. Sharp, whom we trusted as our own souls, have swerved towards Chancellor Hyde's principles, as now we see many do, you have much to answer for. 12 months later, in May 1662, the principal wrote his last letter, and in it he said his final word about the distasteful subject. Had we but petitioned for presbytery at Breda, it had been, as was thought, granted, but fearing what the least delay of the king's coming over might have produced, and trusting fully to the king's goodness, we hastened him over without any provision for our safety. At that time it was that Dr. Sheldon, now Bishop of London, and Dr. Morley did poison Mr. Sharp, our agent, whom we trusted, who piece on piece, in so cunning a way, as trepanned us, as we have never win so much as to petition either King, Parliament, or Council. Okay, if you're struggling with this, essentially, Sharp's heart is being turned out of the way. If you have an unbelieving minister, then it's no surprise, is it, if he becomes the inveterate enemy of the people of God. And this is what happened with Sharp. And he was engaged in intrigue. He was engaged in subterfuge. He was engaged in politics. He became the inveterate persecutor of the people of God. Troy was surrendered now. The citadel of Presbyterianism was overthrown, and a synod with the gates within the gates deceived the townsmen and wrought the ruin. Synod, I think that is. The church, as it was settled by law, was not to be the church of the covenants. When the Recissory Act blotted out the legislation of two decades, and when Sharp pronounced his benediction on the superstructure of which Middleton laid the foundations, the phrase could only mean the church established by James VI and confirmed by his son. So in the harvest of 1661, the Privy Council announced that bishops were to be restored. In December, four men were sent up to London to be consecrated by Anglican dignitaries and thus qualified to impart similar sanctities to their Scottish brethren. James Hamilton, brother of Lord Belhaven, and once active in the service of the Kirk, received the Diocese of Galloway. Andrew Fairfowl, a humorist whose life was not overstrict, yes, said Lord Rothes, he has learning and sharpness enough, but he has no more sanctification than my grey horse. Yes, so Andrew Fairfowl, who has no more sanctification than a grey horse, became the Archbishop of Glasgow. Robert Layton was sent to Dunblane. Robert Layton, the one holy man of the four, of whom Burnet writes in a beautiful sentence that he seemed to be in a perpetual meditation. And James Sharp had the reward of his craft and tireless time-serving in being made their titular head. The minister of Crail was now Archbishop of St. Andrews. A few weeks before, he had ventured once again to visit Douglas in his house in Edinburgh. He told him of the king's purpose to settle the church under bishops and how Charles desired Douglas to accept the primacy. But the true man answered curtly that he would have nothing to do with it. His guest insisted only to receive a second no, and then Sharp rose to take his leave. Robert Douglas conveyed him to the door, but after he had passed through it, he called him back and said, James, I see you will engage. I perceive you are clear. You will be the Bishop of St. Andrews. Take it and the curse of God with it. And instantly clapping him on the shoulder, he shut the door. It was a dramatic parting between those who had been as brothers. Perhaps even this man, seared as his conscience was, felt a tremor of awe as he went down the stair with the good minister's anathema resting on his head. We shall meet Sharp sufficiently often in the future, but we know now why his contemporaries recoiled from him with a shuddering abhorrence. The uncanniest stories were current among them about their arch-enemy. They whispered that he was in league with Satan, and that more than once or twice his ghostly coadjutor was closeted with him in visible shape. My lord, queried a poor creature whom the Archbishop, presiding over the Privy Council, wished to banish for witchcraft to the king's plantations in the West Indies. My lord, who was yon with you in your chamber on Saturday night, betwixt 12 and 1 o'clock? And the Archbishop's face turned both black and pale, and the prisoner was dismissed incontinently from the bar. It seemed as if no diablery were too hideous for the betrayer of the church. Mr. Whittier, the tenderest of American poets, has some terrible verses which he entitles Ichabod, versus that pillory, a statesman, who for a time proved recreant to the cause of emancipation. These are the lines. Of all we loved and honoured, naught save power remains, a fallen angel's pride of thought still strong in chains. They are verses which, if it were not that they invest him with too much intellectual greatness, might have been written about James Sharp, who persecuted that which formerly he preached.